Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the most powerful radio telescope ever conceived or ever made. I'm going to read a Cosmos magazine article from just March 2017, which is last year, and an article called "The Big Data Telescope: The Eyes of the World Are on Outback Western Australia as It Prepares to Build the Most Powerful Radio Telescope Ever Conceived." The Square Kilometre Away SKA, Elizabeth Finkel reports. Now, what I'm doing this is reading articles so I can improve the quality of my podcast, the actual work and flow of the podcast. And I realise that if I read articles just completely raw, where I've never seen it before, I get shocked by certain mistakes, or I get misled by not seeing that this is a box or stuff like that. So I've had a quick read of this, and the basic idea in this, so I'm going to give you the basic idea of it so you can know, is that people have figured out that they can actually stitch radio telescopes together, so you can have a whole lot of modest radio telescopes and you can just stitch them together and use their garbled signals, ungarble them. So it's not as good as a huge continent-sized telescope, but you can actually have a whole lot of small telescopes and stitch them together. But to do that, you need enormous data processing. And so the data processing for this, which is the major idea behind it, will involve supercomputers and data flows which exceeds the flow of the entire internet. Now, the advantage of this is that for the slow frequency work, it can go back and probe the hydrogen gas clouds at the very start of the universe. And there's a fine splitting line in hydrogen between the, I suppose it must be the singlet and triplet. Can't see how it's a triplet. Okay. Oh, hydrogen molecular gas, it must be. Okay. This is the 21-centimetre, famous 21-centimetre line, the most ubiquitous hyperfine splitting, which fills the universe with radiation. Of course, this is now spread out from ancient times, the redshift. So let's start reading this article. The byline: on a flat red mulga plain in the outback of Western Australia, preparations are underway to build the most audacious telescope astronomers have ever dreamed of, the Square Kilometre Away SKA. The next generation telescopes usually aim to double the performance of their predecessors. The Australian arm of the SKA will deliver a 168-fold leap in the best technology available today to show us the universe as never before. It will tune into signals emitted just a million years after the Big Bang. Okay, or 400,000. When the universe was a sea of hydrogen gas, slowly percolating with the first galaxies. Their starlight illuminated the fledgling universe in what was referred to as the cosmic dawn. Okay, well, there was a sizable gap in the Dark Ages. Okay. It is the last non-understood event in the history of the universe, says Stuart Wythe, a theoretical astrophysicist at the University of Melbourne, Australia. Like any dream, realisation is the hard part. In 2018, when the first of 1,300 Christmas tree antennas is deployed in the sandy plains of Murchison, an almost uninhabited district of the 50,000 square kilometres, it will mark the 28 years since its conception. Epic battles have brought the project to this point, most famously the six-year contest between countries to host the telescope. Australia and South Africa ended up sharing the prize. The SKA's telescope in South Africa will be built on another flat red plain, the Kuru region of North Cape. It has somewhat less lofty ambitions. Its dishes will probe only halfway to the edge of the universe. The Monkia SKA mid denotes the mid-range frequencies of radio waves stretched across this distance. Australia's SKA low, by contrast, will tune into the low frequencies emanating from the extremities of the cosmos. Together with the two telescopes, WILL represents the largest science facility on the planet, says the SKA director of the radio astronomer Phil Diamond, who is based in Jodrell Bank Observatory in the UK. The game-changing technology that led us to hear the whispers of the newborn stars against the cacophony of the universe doesn't involve grinding mirrors to atom-thin smoothness or constructing dishes the size of sports fields. The disruptive technology here is supercomputing. Once SKA Low is running, it will generate more data every day than the world's internet traffic. Dealing with this deluge is a challenge being tackled by hefty global collaborations of academia and private enterprise, and it is by no means clear how it will be solved. It's a scale no one has attempted before, says Peter Quinn, a computational astrophysics physicist at University of Western Australia and director of the International Centre for Radio Astronomy Research, ICRARA, in Perth. While international mega-science projects have been tackled before, think of the European Organisation for Nuclear Research, CERN, which operates the world's largest particle accelerator in the Large Hadron Collider. When it comes to the SKA, the potential for world-changing spin-offs has never been so blazingly obvious. CERN didn't just find the Higgs boson. Computer scientist Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web to manage the information sharing. Wi-Fi was the spin-off when Australian CSIRO astronomers developed ways to realign scrambled radio signals from black holes. Mega corporations such as Cisco, Woodside, Chevron, Rio Tinto and Google are already positioned to coordinate with the SKA astronomers around the world. The science project has of this grandeur managed across 10 countries involving dozens of specialist technical consortia and thousands of people is challenging enough. The question of how to divvy up the pie for construction and contracts and commercial spin-offs that follows adds a whole new complicated layer. But astronomers have a great track record when it comes to testing their way through gnarly collaborations to deliver triumphs such as the Hubble Space Telescope and the Atacama Large Array. After nearly 25 years of wrangling, the signs are that their first binding SKA treaty will be signed earlier this year, committing 10 member countries, Australia, Canada, China, India, Italy, New Zealand, South Africa, Sweden, Netherlands and the UK to funding the contracts for the 2018 rollout. Even with the treaty, SKA will remain a confusing beast, not one telescope but two located in two countries, with headquarters in a third UK. Despite its name, neither of the Phase 1 telescopes slated for construction actually boasts a square kilometre collecting area. That won't be realised until Phase 2 of the project, negotiations for which are yet to begin. Nonetheless, the gears of the vast project slowly grind into action. Australia is bracing to host the first global mega-science project. It will be our CERN down under, says CSIRO astronomer Sarah Pierce, Australia's science representative for the SKA board. She adds, don't expect a tour. It's here precisely because there are very, very few people. The curious thing about astronomy is that telescopes, as they grow more powerful, turn into time machines. When Galileo saw Jupiter, he saw it as appeared 42 minutes earlier, the time it took for light to reach him. Hubble's iconic image of the Horsehead Nebula in the constellation Orion was a snapshot that took 1,500 years. Astronomers who conceived the SKA had their sights set way beyond 100,000 light-year dimensions of our own galaxy. The faint signals they seek began their journey more than 13 billion years ago, just a few million years after the Big Bang. After that point, the hot plasma of electrons and photons cooled enough to fuse to form the simplest atom, hydrogen. Except for a slight ripple here and there, the universe was a featureless sea of it. Today, things are different. The sea is dotted with galaxies. But how did these galactic islands form? To find out requires a telescope that can look back to the rippling hydrogen seas of 13 billion years ago. That's why the SKA was originally called the Hydrogen Telescope, Quinn says. That's the Hydrogen 21 line, my friend. Those who imagined the SKA had just had a lust for hydrogen, the appetite had been wet by the very large array, VLA, of 27 dishes lying 80 kilometers west of Sirocco in New Mexico. Now known as the Jansky VLA, the telescope generated some of the first detailed maps of atomic hydrogen. The bond between hydrogen's electrons and protons emits a unique 21-centimeter radio wave. Because the universe is expanding, the waves emitted from the outer space have stretched by the time they reach us. The further away it is, the greater the stretching. The hydrogen waves emanating from the edge of the universe measure 1.5 meters for the time they reach Earth. It's known as the Doppler effect on Earth. We experience it when we hear the sound of an ambulance siren deepen as it speeds away. Its sound waves are stretching as it goes. In 1990, the 10th anniversary of the VLA, the world's radio astronomers met to celebrate one of New Mexico's facility's crowning achievements, mapping of hydrogen in nearby galaxies. Ron Erks, the Australian former director of the array, recalls that everyone was in a high. Not content to rest on their laurels, a small group of visionary astronomers wondered how far the technology could be pushed. Egdon Peter Wilkinson from the University of Manchester in Britain pitched the idea of reaching out to galaxies at the edge of the universe. The total collecting area of 1 square kilometre, he figured, should do the job. The audacity of proposing was amazing, Quinn said. Most telescopes' improvements aim at a 2 to 3-fold increase. This proposal represented a 10,000-fold increase. That figure reflected a 50-fold increase in sensitivity, amplified by a 200-fold increase in field of view. Oh, yes, okay. The goal was to see the Milky Way at the edge of the universe, Quinn adds, and to scour the entire southern sky. The breakthrough needed to enable this leap did not lie in a fancy new telescope's design, but in an explosion of computing power techniques able to handle massive amount of data. The receivers themselves could be little more than antennas tuned to radio wavelengths that would pick up the extra long wavelengths of distant hydrogen. Coincidentally, the same wavelength used by FM radio stations. This is where the early universe is broadcasting, says Quinn. You can just hear it because it's buried in the crackle. The more antenna, the greater the sensitivity, helps the planned 1 square kilometre collecting service. But antennas don't need to be in the same spot. Indeed, the more spread out they are, the sharper their focus, their resolution. How does a forest of radio telescopes antenna figure out where in the sky a signal came from? Interferometry, a technique developed by British and Australian radio astronomers in the 1940s, is a key. It relies on the principle that each antenna in the array receives a signal at a slightly different time. For instance, the radio waves coming from the easterly part of the sky hit the easterlymost antenna earlier than those lying in the west. By electronically tweaking the delay on each, the entire forest could be made to point in a particular direction of the sky. By using interferometry to tune into the signals from the edge of the universe, it would require filtering astronomical amounts of data, and that was a challenge to be mastered. The tussle. In 2000, the SKA steering committee led by Elkers invited proposals to home the telescope. 5 countries responded to help their bids. Some built serious prototypes known as Pathfinders. The result was an astronomical bonanza. Bonanza built the majestic dishes of the Australian Square Kilometre Away Pathfinder, ASK, and the antenna forest at Murchison Widefield Away, the MWA. South Africa built 7 dishes of Cat 7 and built the larger Meerkat. China began working on a prototype which paved the way for the 5,000-metre aperture spherical radio telescope FAST, the largest single radio dish in the world. Geography worked against some of the contestants. The Chinese side wasn't flat enough. The joint Brazilian undertaking bid was let down by turbulent ionosphere, the uppermost layer of the atmosphere, which distorted the sought-after low frequencies. By 2006, Australia and South Africa were the last countries standing. Both laid claim to the vast, unpopulated regions free of radio waves, interference, and relatively placid ionosphere. the South African site's higher elevation was in favour. Australia, on the other hand, had an impressive track record in Australian astronomy. It boasted some of the world's first interferometers, built in 1940s at Dover Heights, south of Sydney, and the iconic CSIRO telescope operating since 1961. The contest was fierce for good reason. The SKA's benefits clearly stretched far beyond astronomy. The devices and algorithms developed to pursue SKA's goal may be the next Wi-Fi, the next multi-trillion dollar technology market, says Stephen Stinger, the former director of MWA and now leads Italy's SKA involvement. Whichever country hosted SKA would be at the heart of the action, attracting the training of the next generation of engineers and scientists in advanced manufacturing, telecommunications and high-performance computing. Accompanied by a sort of media attention usually reserved to football grand final, a competitive and secretive bidding process ensued. In May 2012, members of the SKA organisation voted to split the array between Australian and African sites. South African telescope would observe radio waves at 350 megahertz to 14 gigahertz, enabling it to detect signals from 6 billion light years away. A still sparse chapter in the universe's life's history. It would use dishes like those of the JVLA, but dramatically increase the speed and sensitivity. Australia's array would detect frequencies in the range of 50 to 350 megahertz, ideal for detecting hydrogen signals from the edge of the universe. But both would rely on the development of disruptive new computational techniques. We believe we know how to do it, but I'm not hiding the fact that's the challenge, Diamond says, building it. Getting the Australian site of the SKA gives the words isolation and quiet a whole new meaning. First, you make your way to Perth itself, one of the most isolated cities in the world. Then another one-hour flight to the 350-strong port of Geraldton. From there, bump around for 4 dusty hours on a four-wheel drive until, finally, on the horizon, you see a succession of towering 12-metre telescope dishes. You've arrived at the Murchison Radio Astronomy Observatory. 36 dishes comprise ASCAP. Despite the name, they are not the prototype SKA LOW. Their honour goes to the MWA, a rather less majestic affair that lies hidden in the nearby Mulga Scrub. A 2,084-squat wiry antenna resembling a swarm of giant spiders. Unlike ASCAP, MWA has no moving parts to point to different parts of the sky. That's because it's a software telescope. It relies on computer programs to different delays to the antenna, to the signals, to the same patch of sky are collected at the same time. Amid great fanfare, MWA first came online in mid-2013. I didn't hear about it. According to the director, Ronald Wythe, it has blazed the trail for the SKA LOW. It tuned in and received signals from the early universe within a bandwidth of 60 to 250 megahertz. It does not have the sensitivity to detect features of the cosmic dawn, but its impressive 30-degree field of view allows it to map the entire visible sky over a few nights. The Galactic and Extragalactic All-Sky MWA GLEAM survey, for instance, mapped bubbles of ionized hydrogen gas and quasars from up to 6 billion light years away. Two trailblazing aspects of its operation are the key to SKA LOW. The first, it has pioneered methods to adjust the distorting effects of the ionosphere above Murchison. It's like trying to see something at the bottom of a rippling pool, explained Roth. Luckily for us, it's usually just small ripples. Filtering out ripples in the ionosphere is just one step of the multi-pronged data processing operation, whose ultimate aim is to deliver sharp images of the ancient universe. Another early step reduces the noise inherent in the system. The heart of every radio telescope is an on-site computer known as a correlator. Developed through partnership with IBM and Cisco, the MWA's correlator compares signals from each of the 2,048 antenna. Noise is random, real signals are correlated. By accepting only correlated signals, this step reduces the data to a manageable 1% of the initial deluge. For the next phase takes place off-site. At 800 kilometres optic fibre, ferries the pre-filtered data from the desert to the Pawsey Supercomputer Centre in Perth. A mirror link takes it to collaborators in Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston, Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand, to be used by 35 different science projects. Just as the human brain must process vast amounts of data into meaningful representations of the world, the supercomputers turn the MWA radio wave signals into pictures of the universe. There are data from across different regions of the sky and across tens of thousands of frequencies. It is sifted by setting windows to extract cubes of information, like pixels on the screen. They provide an image of the universe. The MWA's coarse resolution means that its cubes can't produce a sharp image. SKA, with its 100-fold greater sensitivity and 40-fold increase in resolution, will provide more cubes to show us what that's actually there. But in order to do that, it must solve the data deluge problem. This is a thinking break in the middle of this podcast, brought to you courtesy of software that I've written, which allows me to just stitch various dictaphone recordings together. As I sort of run out of steam or get interrupted, I have to interrupt these longer podcasts. But it occurred to me that I try to remember what the 21 centimeter radiation that everyone is listening to. It's this very essential radiation, signature radiation of hydrogen. And I sort of, as a spectroscopist, always look at the hyperfine splitting of energetic transitions that you can see in your spectroscope, the visible, the Bormer series, the Paschen series in hydrogen you'll be aware of. And I was trying to remember what this was. So it's a very characteristic, earthy center. It's a sort of radiation, pretty much a little bit bigger than your hand span, supposedly. And it permeates the entire universe. And it's this signature radiation. It's like the fundamental radiation. And its story came from very early radio telescopes where they found, or radio receivers, they found that there was this hiss at 21 centimetres, and they thought, oh look, let's try and work out where it's coming from. First guess was the sun, that proved not to be correct. It seemed to be coming from Sagittarius, around the area that we now know is the centre of the universe, the centre of the galaxy. So our galaxy was producing this amazing hiss, and this hiss, fortunately, the hiss goes to longer and longer wavelengths. So at 22 centimeters, you can you tune your wavelengths, your telescopes to that, your receivers to that. You'll see a little bit further out, and then eventually, if you tune to, I think, several metres length, a metre or so length, you'll see right to the edge of the universe, looking at this hiss of neutral hydrogen. And this is one of the basic things, I suppose, missing from this article as we're reading it. What is the actual mechanism? What is actually driving the mechanism that's going on? And so let's talk our way through it. So what happened is that there was the Big Bang, everything was a uniform soup, nothing really, there was no clumping together of stars, and everything was ionized because it initially was so hot, then it cooled down, and everything turned into a neutral, transparent gas. And this is at 400,000 years after the Big Bang, and that sparked a Dark Ages. From 400,000 to 400 million years after the Big Bang, when very powerful stars and black holes began to form, and this produced radiation, newly produced radiation, and this radiation re-ionized the Dark Ages. So the Dark Ages was just a primordial soup of neutral hydrogen, and after that, these stars and quasars and black holes and powerful ionization sources began to burn up the universe again, producing resonant radiation. This is radiation which just ionized all the hydrogen. So most of the hydrogen now in deep space before it's clumped together is ionized. We're in the reionization era. So the reionization era lasts from 400 million years after the Big Bang right up to the present, which is 13.8 billion years or giga years after the Big Bang. So what's this hydrogen, neutral hydrogen, producing any radiation? How can it be? And it's not that the electron's in an excited state. It's to do with the spin and the fact that electrons and protons are little magnets, and they're sort of quantum magnets. So they align or counter-align to the prevailing magnetic field. And this is a quantum feature, so it's unlike something, a object that you have. You may have your coffee cup, and you may have it facing the hole at the top, or the hole to the table. And you can think that you can flip this, and you can imagine flipping it slowly. But in quantum mechanics, it can only ever be down, or it can actually pull through itself to be up. It can't actually rotate. And this is to do, it's also to do with angular momentum, to do with the cooling of the universe, cooling of the dimensions of the universe, which meant that we had X, Y, and Z as translationally invariant things, but you have an absolute frame of reference for rotation. And that absolute frame of reference for rotation gives you all these things like angular momentum, Planck's constant, and the fact that these particles have S2 symmetry. And they can have spin up or spin down, that is, north pole up or north pole down for the magnetic moment of both the electron and the proton. So if I get a beam of electrons and fire it through a magnet, which will bend it down, but then balance it up against, well, just say if I fire it and curve it through a magnet, the electrons will go on just two slightly different trajectories. And if I have a screen, I'll see not a single dot, but these are a very, very small thing you see. It's broken into two little islands. Now, I know, you know, in the red tube, you've got electrons hitting it through, and you get it swept by magnetic fields. Have a swept by magnetic fields because that's cheaper, because you can have the magnetic fields on the outside of your tube. But if you actually built a really high precision TV set, you'll see the final dot is broken into two points. That's because the magnetic field's up and down. And so there's this fundamental thing that even at low heat, you can actually excite, thermally excite these neutral hydrogens, and such that, and bump into them, and the only thing you do is you flip the spin of the electron such the two north poles are facing upwards. Or it depends how you think of it, that the north pole will pull each other in the electron. It's again hard to visualize, and it's really not a three-dimensional thing. People often draw the electrons as a tiny little dot orbiting the nucleus, but the quantum mechanics has a different picture of it. You can actually have hydrogen when you just have neutral hydrogen, even at a reasonable temperature. There'll be a fraction of the hydrogens radiating as their electrons are flipped. And that's a higher energy state, and after a certain while, that will emit this 21 centimeter radiation. So, basically, if you've got some neutral hydrogen atoms and you just heat them up a little bit, so this spin flipping of the electron will radiate out this 21 centimeter radiation. Now, this is, as a spectroscopist, spin flipping within one state is hard enough to understand, but spin transitions are where spin flips is normally forbidden. So this is going to take me a while to fully understand. I suppose the moral of the story is that radio astronomy sounds far more hard to access what's going on exactly here if you don't actually understand that people are listening to a spin flip of neutral hydrogen. If they said that up the front, and if you introduce that to students, if you're teaching this, I think you'd get a far greater interest in what's going on. Thanks for listening, and back to the article. Just rereading the last paragraph, because I've had that interlude. The first phase of the SKA low will churn out raw data at a daily rate greater than the world's internet traffic. Impossible to store for human minds to process in real time, ingenious algorithms will be needed to sift the valuable nuggets from the deluge. The University of Cambridge leads a consortium of 23 organisations, including Perth's ICRA, to develop a new hardware and software systems for the task. One of ICRA's major software contributions goes by the name of Deluge, a acronym for Data Activated Logical Graph Engine. It's also a bilingual play on the word Lu, is Chinese character meaning fly. Last June, ICRA team successfully ran a prototype of the Deluge on a second most powerful supercomputer in the world, Taihei 2, in Guangzhou, China. Next, the team hopes to test it on the most powerful, the Sunway Tellulite in Wuxi, eastern China. My God, China's really going bang gangbusters with it. The computing challenges may be huge, but it's not the first time the global community has taken on something so big. To solve CERN's problems of distributed processing and information sharing, its researchers ended up developing the World Wide Web. That changed our world forever, Quinn says. I expect SKA will do the same. SKA's rewards are already reaching beyond science into industry. Besides Cisco and IBM, another big collaborators on the project include British-Australian mining giant Rio Tinto, international gas and oil company Chevron, Amazon and Intel. All are highly attuned to the new ways of solving the big data problems, whether it's crunching data to make images of oil, gas, mineral deposits below the ground, or finding patterns in vast databases. Construction of in the middle of nowhere. The computational challenges of SKA are formidable. So are those involved building and rolling out an infrastructure in the middle of the Australian outback. It's a perfect job for a former Army tank officer. Tim Bula has been project manager of the MWA and part of the SKA low team since 2011. His mission is to plan the construction and development of 130,000 antennas in the desert. Absent a local workforce and no construction equipment and no power grid, and that's only the first phase of SKA low. The second phase is slated for the mid-2020s. Pending funding, we'll see the number of antennas swell to about a million. The scale and cost and remoteness of the site makes it one of the toughest science projects ever undertaken. Supplying power is a major hurdle. The MWA is powered by a 1.6 megawatt hybrid solar diesel generator station, part of which must be shielded to stop the radio waves it creates from interfering with the telescope. Phase 1 of the SKA low will need 2.25 megawatt. Phase 2 will need the power supply of a small city. Extreme weather also has to be factored in. 2015, nearby Milibili station bore a year's worth of rain in 5 minutes. While the cattle grazers welcomed it, Road closures disrupted plans for an observatory. Besides sudden downpours, Boole's also has to reckon with the temperature soaring over 40 degrees in the summer months. And then there's the desert death adder. But one thing's for sure. But one thing the Shire of Merchant has going for it, and the reason it won the SKA grid, is its quiet. Population density is extremely low, just 115 people spread over an area the size of the Netherlands. There's no mobile phone towers or radio television transmitters. The Shire is also hushed by regulations enforced by the Australian Communications and Media Authority. Within the observatory, every appliance gets stripped of the Wi-Fi hardware before it arrives. The observatory's control centre, which houses computers that crunch the data from the existing telescopes, is the radio equivalent of an airlock with radio wave-proof double doors and no windows. Inside a radius of 70 kilometres around the observatory, authorities can order mobile phones to be turned off. Out to 260 kilometres, emissions are regulated in key frequency ranges. The entire area is more than six times bigger than the US National Radio Quiet Zone, home to the Green Bank Radio Telescope, and a population running into the hundreds of thousands. As difficult as building the SKA will be, coming up with the money to bankroll it is trickier. Negotiations with 10 participating governments for the first phase have been underway since 2015. But there's a new sense of ease prevailing into the SKA community as it looks to an April 17 sign-off of a binding treaty known as the International Government Organization. Once signed, ministers from each country will have a year to ratify it. Once ratified, the researchers are confident things will roll out smoothly. There is a strong precedent. CERN is governed by an IGO with 22 member states. It's well-tested model, says Pierce, who previously worked on the computing challenges of the LHC as part of the multinational collaboration. The SKA low expected to come online in 2021 and be fully operational by 2024, astronomers can at last allowing themselves to get excited. Until we can put a radio telescope on the moon, it will be the greatest advance in low-frequency radio astronomy, says Elizabeth Mills, a radio astronomer at the San Jose University in California. With such a great leap in technical capabilities, the most important advances for this telescope will be areas we cannot even currently predict or imagine. Okay, I'm just going to read again. So this is a large, low-frequency hydrogen sensing telescope. I wish I would say that. 21 centimeters radiation of the electron, hydrogen electron spin flipping. I'm going to have to understand the quantum mechanics of that, because spin flipping is forbidden. It's mentally really hard for me to comprehend the actual dipole transition moment of that. It's just blows my brain away. I have to know that. And it there's this region after the first ionization, the Dark Ages, which goes from 400,000 to 400 million years after the Big Bang, and at 400 million years ago, stars and galaxies burst light in and cause ionization of the hydrogen, reducing the amount of hydrogen. So this is going to probe that dark region, that low frequency stuff. It's low frequency because it's now time dilated significantly. Renat here is Back to the Cosmic Dawn. This is a supplementary article. We know something of the first few moments of the violent births of our universe. A split second after the Big Bang, it was a tiny mushrooming fireball, 10 billion degrees hot and filled with plasma and frenetic charged particles. Over the next 380,000 years, the expanding universe cooled. Changed charged particles, electrons and protons lost enough of their youthful energy to bond with each other and form the first hydrogen atoms. In this more staid universe, light from the Big Bang could at last move under move in uninterrupted and straight lines. As space continued to expand, the light waves stretched to the length of microwaves, which is we see today as the cosmic microwave background. This much we know. The next episode remains a mystery. At 360,000 years old, the universe was a peaceful sea of hydrogen. A billion years later, most of it was gone. We know a small percentage snowballed under the influence of gravity to form stars and galaxies, but the vast intergalactic sea of hydrogen disappeared, reionized into a plasma of protons and electrons, the era known as the epoch of reionization. How did it happen? It turned out there's lots there are lots of theories, and most of them are completely unconstrained by data. Traces of dark matter laid down by the Big Bang, slightly denser than their surrounds, may have triggered snowballing of hydrogen into stars. But why did the intergalactic hydrogen disappear? It's an interesting thing. I didn't think about that one. The leading theory is ultraviolet radiation from the first hot stars stripped the surrounding hydrogen gas of its electrons. But there are other contenders, quasi-stellar radio sources, among the brightest and oldest objects of the universe. They are powered by black holes, and the source of light are the radiation emitted by accelerating gases as they are sucked towards the accretion disk. Quasars can be surprisingly ancient, appearing just 770 million years after the Big Bang. It's controversial, but it's exciting. Possibility that it was a quasar that reionized the universe, said astrophysicist Wayne Stewart of the University of Melbourne, who specializes in trying to recreate the unknown period of history of the universe. The theory also suggests that massive black holes may have played a far greater role in shaping the universe than we previously thought. In White's computer modeling, the ancient universe resembles Swiss cheese. The cheese is neutral hydrogen, and the holes are where they've been eaten away, leaving ionized plasma. Over a period of about 300 million years, the holes grow larger until, by about a billion years, there after the Big Bang, there's almost no cheese left. SKA's low is designed to supply theorists like Wirth with hard data. It will have the resolution and the wide angle to map out the distribution of hydrogen in the early universe and trace out how it changed over time. We will combine these images with those of Hubble's Space Telescope to try and detect what the center of those cheesy holes stars are, stars or quasars. So what they'll look back is, if you can imagine a complete hydrogen sea, and then that hydrogen sea will eventually froth and bubble and disappear. That's interesting. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.